This is the podcast on Saikaku's Life of a Sensuous Woman, a really popular novel at the time, with that rise of realism in Japan. If you've taken a look at the Yoshiwara Floating World and the Saikaku biographical webpage, you can kind of situate him in 18th century Japan with the rise of realism, the rise of a middle class that starts to read about itself, that actually has the, as I think I've mentioned elsewhere, has the leisure time and the money so that they can actually become literate and have the time and the inclination to read. So Saikaku rides these two waves of kind of a growing middle or merchant class, and this fascination as manifested in the floating world, this fascination with human sexuality, reading things that may or may not be that we would consider prurient. Now, there's kind of a lot of sex in this, and in fact, the sex is kind of what drives this story. It drives, in fact, Saikaku's entire career. He's got Life of an Amorous Man, he's got Five Women Who Loved Love. All of these texts are, you know, basically giving the public what they want, coming long after, a while after he was a poet, right, kind of made his living teaching poetry. But after the death of his wife and spending 2 years as a wandering mendicant, like a lay monk, which was not common at the time, but far more common at that time than it would be now, he turns to prose and kind of cranks out these, we might consider them to be pulp novels or pulp fiction, kind of, you know, B-grade stuff. But it was incredibly popular and addressed some serious social issues as well. Life of a Sensuous Woman begins with this idea of our narrator who's essentially eavesdropping, follows and kind of stalks these two guys to where they go, to a woman's hermitage, right, the place where an old woman lives alone, and then he listens to the old woman tell them this story and takes down this story. Right? I want to pay attention to who these two guys are that are listening, because they kind of stand in for us as the audience. But I also want to look at what Saikaku as the author is doing. The very first line that we start with, a beautiful woman, many ages have agreed, is an axe that cuts down a man's life. Well, you know, this is Life of a Sensuous Woman, and this is not a really good way to pitch women here, right? Beautiful women will kill men. Yeah, I can understand how he might feel that way, but certainly what he's doing here, and he's going to do it all throughout this text, is he's going to give us little insertions, these authorial intrusions, where he steps in and gives us a moral that may or may not have anything to do with the text, and to be honest, most of them don't have much to do with the text. But what he's doing is the exact same thing that the shogun was doing with Yoshiwara. He's able to talk about sex, to write about sex, but if he couches it in the terms of, well, I want people to learn from this, then he's really able to, point to the religious authorities, essentially the Buddhist monks or the Shinto monks who are kind of running the religious apparatus in Japan at this time. He's able to say, well, look, see, I've filled it with these morals and told people to take these lessons from this text. Right? No one escapes death, he says. The invisible blossoms of the mind finally fall and scatter. The soul leaves and the body is fed into the crematorium, right? And yet, the young die of overindulgence. And so take this as a warning, and I'm going to show you what happens with overindulgence. Okay, he sets it all up in kind of a frame story, but we get the real frame, right? It's kind of not the bulk of the story. The meat of the story is this woman's life as she recounts it to these young men. But in reality, that's all couched in terms of these two young men listening to her and our narrator eavesdropping on her talking to the two young men. If we look at those two young men, though, they become really significant for us. The first guy, as we said, he's dressed in the latest style, but disheveled, right? His face is pale and he's thin and worn, obviously from too much lovemaking. Well, I don't know that that's really obvious, but it is for Saikaku, and he needs you to accept this as, you know, willing suspension of disbelief here and assume that that's because of too much lovemaking. He looked like he didn't have much time left and was getting ready to leave his inheritance to his own parents. So this idea that leaving his inheritance to his own, he's going to die before his parents will die. Well, that's just the reverse of the natural order of the world, right? Sad to say, all of us in the natural order of things will end up burying our parents. But too much love reverses this natural order. Right? It makes the young die first. It will kill us all. And our young man says, right, I've had everything I've wanted in life. I've never lacked anything at all. But there's one thing I really would like. I wish my pledging liquid could keep flowing on and on like this river and never stop. Now, that pledging liquid is an incredible euphemism. Literally, what he's talking about is his semen. He's saying, listen, I wish I could die just right. I wish I could just keep on having sex and having sex and having sex until I die from it, basically. I wish my pledging liquid would keep on flowing and never stop. And that's what he wants to kill him. Now, his friend says, what I'd like, however, is the exact opposite. A country without women. Find a quiet place to live, far from any town, take good care of myself, live to a decent old age. Right? This is what he's looking for. On one extreme, we have a guy who wants to die just having sex all the time. On the other guy, we have a sexless guy who says, I don't want anything like that. I want a world without women, without relationships, without sex. I don't want anything like that. Both of these are totally unrealistic. Right? They don't explain the human experience. But what they do is that as surrogates for us as the audience, they set us up as somewhere in the middle. Right? None of us are going to have sex 24/7. And none of us are going to spend our life sexlessly alone in a hermitage doing absolutely nothing, right? With no contact with the opposite sex. Real humanity, our experience occurs in both of those. And so what we get is that the old woman inserting herself in between those two. Yes, she has lots of sex, and that really goes against kind of the traditional cultural gender roles of the time. What we find out is that she invented this technique. She's 11 years old when she starts to rebel against the kind of standard social order, right? She falls in love with, let's call him, the one true love of her life, this young samurai who is eventually killed. We get this nice little idea of love as a kind of religion or sense of worship because, right, when she burns these love letters happening still in that first chapter, it's as if they are some kind of offering to the gods. She says, the places, the letters where the men swore by their patron gods that their love for me was true and would never change, those places, he said, didn't burn, right? Because they are all, she burns all these love letters as if they were some offering to the gods, right? And then she enters into this kind of dream state with the ghost, and then kind of gives you the standard old lady speech. Kids these days, they grow up too fast. And kids these days, they just jump right in. Well, the irony of this, maybe we could even say the hypocrisy of this, is here's a woman who's like fighting against the traditional female role when she's 11 years old, right? She's jumping right into this, right? And so she gives us some of the moralizing that we would expect from the author, Saikaku, that we see him already inserting in here. We get this moralizing and misogyny, and the greatness of it is that it's coming from a woman, which, you know, sets us up to see her kind of walk through her life. Right? She eventually becomes this mistress of the domain lord, where we see that this is totally, this isn't a love relationship. This is an economic relationship, as she says. It won't be easy to find a woman who meets all these requirements. If this woman exists, we'll find her for you. And they send somebody out to get her, and they look for suitable candidates and these employment agencies, as if your job is to come be a wife, right? So it's, you know, it's like going to monster.com or dice.com and, you know, one of the job boards and finding, hey, be my wife. It's not quite mail order bride stuff, but it certainly looks like it in pitching love as a totally economic move. It's, there's, right, that's not the only thing a woman has to worry about, right? There's the party with the kabuki actors near the theaters, again, talking about Yoshiwara there, right? And this idea that she comes to as she is this, that if you're beautiful, if you're young and you're beautiful especially, you get to decide the quality and the course of your life. As she says, everything was, I got to set the conditions myself, right? If you're beautiful, I agreed to this interview and the agents are anxious and I didn't even put on any good clothes or makeup when I got there, right? The retainer thought I was even better than the woman in the painting, so the search was called off. So I get to make the rules because I'm the best looking one. Really, the retainer knows absolutely nothing about her except that she's good looking, right? So we get this connection here, right? And she's going to tie that back to sex as well, especially when she talks about Moronobu's suggested prints. Those prints, if you take the time to Google those, right, they are pictures of women masturbating. So this is the kind of erotic, it's the 18th century Japanese equivalent of porn, I guess. They're far fancier than we'd expect from anything online, right? And they're far more than suggestive, I gotta admit, if you take a look at them, right? And this kind of, not only is she misogynistic here, she's also setting us up that the idea that men are faithful because of fear. Fear of a jealous woman is what keeps men faithful. As if men are essentially beasts who can't control their own thoughts and feelings, or certainly even if they can't control their own thoughts and feelings, they can't help but act upon them, right? And it's only fear of a jealous woman that keeps men faithful to one woman. We move then, right, to pull out another part of the story where she starts talking about how she's the monk's wife in a small temple, right, which is ironic because Buddhism, right, here is all about detachment, right? The ideal life for the Buddhist is one that removes desire, right? The fire of desire, right? The wheel of pain. Desire for a Buddhist causes pain and keeps you in their cycle of rebirth, the transmigration of souls, it might be called. It keeps you in that cycle. You keep on getting reborn and reborn until you get it right, until you live without desire, not without interest, right? There's a difference between being disinterested and uninterested, right? Disinterested attachment is what they're looking for. You're concerned, but it is not going to overwhelm you, and you are not going to let it rule your life, right? But here she is running into, like, this monk, and we see this, right, this kind of religious commentary here, this general decay of religious discipline. The monks themselves, who should be moral exemplars, are themselves, you know, kind of tawdry, not really, you know, people we'd look up to, really kind of, you know, think of Brother Giroflée, the guy we just saw in Candide. It's the same type of thing here. And then the next section, I think, talks about an area that I really like, this notion of the power of writing, the ability to express your thoughts, and more to the point, the ability to help someone else express their thoughts is a form of power. It gives her economic and social freedom as she writes letters, as she articulates for men what it is that they try to communicate to her that she's feeling, right? So she has this kind of a letter writing business that's really popular. And of course, there are most of these love letters, right? That's, you know, we get this section more or less ends with her talking about meeting one of her customers and realizing the woman he's writing to or she's writing to for him doesn't deserve him. Right? And so she throws herself at him. And as she says, I made love with that man day and night. When he lost his desire, I strengthened him with, you know, basically, you know, these home remedies for male potency. Gradually, he ran dry, and it was pitiful to see him shivering, still wearing thick winter robes. Every doctor had given up on him. Literally, she kills him with sex. Right? And then we get this kind of odd section that begins with kickball, right? Which tells us a little bit more about the old woman who's saying, how she, right, you may speak about anything at all, Yoshioka told us. Don't hold anything back. Confess something you yourself did. How you blocked another woman's love for a man and hated her. How you were jealous of a man going to see another woman and spoke badly of him. This kind of, do you know this term, Schadenfreude? It's rejoicing in another's bad luck or misfortune or dire deeds that happen to them, right? This kind of vicarious thrill at seeing someone else who's worse off than you are. And of course, in this section, we also have this kind of offhand misogyny again. She's a typical woman who lets her emotions run away from her. Well, that's an odd thing for a woman to say, right? Talking trash about other women. And then we come to this section about the 500 disciples of the last section of the text, the 500 disciples of the Buddha, right? Where sex brings about redemption, which is totally paradoxical, right? If disciples of the Buddha are about renunciation of desire, she's saying basically use them up until their desire is gone. It'll make it easier for them, right? So sex brings about this achievement of the term is moksha, this ability to remove yourself from this cycle of pain. She asks for it. In fact, she prays for it, right? She prays for removal. She says, I thought it, I at least ought to pray for the one thing I could still wish for, to be reborn in Amida Buddha's pure land paradise. That idea of moving beyond the cycle of birth and rebirth, moving beyond the wheel of fire, the wheel of desire. And what we find out is there are 500 monks there, and she is sleeping with all of them, right? She's believing, or maybe trying to convince herself, that she has somehow helped them in their path to enlightenment by helping them remove their desire, right? As if desire were some kind of finite thing that we possess within us, right? Like physical strength. Desire is an act of the will. It's something we want, right? Let's call it an act of the heart, even. Because it's certainly not an act of the brain or the body. It's what we want. Does one of these 500 disciples resemble your dead child? Is one your husband? Why were you crying so hard? Right? When she gets, right, their gentle voices make her feel even more ashamed for what she's doing. But she's screwing her courage to the sticking place here and trying to get back into this. Well, think of this, she says finally, as my sincere confession of all the bad things I've ever done. This has, in fact, cleared the clouds of attachment from me, and I feel my mind now shining bright as the moon. The purgative experience of telling her story, almost, if you think about the notion of in Christianity, the confessional, right? This is what we get. This has purged her of her desire when she's kind of laying out all these sins. And the actual novel itself has many more sections like this, where it's just, but I think our text gives you enough to let you know the tenor of the work, right? I'm not hiding anything from you, and no husband or no children. I have no reason to. Who am I going to embarrass besides myself? Who am I going to kind of allow myself to unburden myself to, right? The lotus flower in my heart opened for you. Before it closed, it told everything from beginning to end. I've certainly worked in some dirty professions, but is my heart not pure? And that is truly the fundamental question, right? Yes, her heart may be pure. She sees it as pure because she's able to frame everything she's done as somehow either necessary or helping others, right? This is the function of the kind of the meaning of her life, and it becomes this kind of corollary to, well, the same way we saw Candide do tending his garden, right? This is the process. The telling of this story, the story we're reading, is the process she uses to clear herself, to remove the desire, to expose herself, literally, to make herself vulnerable to us as the kind of the surrogates for the two men and the eavesdropper, as she tells her story.